This is Free Speech Radio News for International Women's Day, Friday, March 8, 2002. I'm Nell Abram. Zimbabwe's highest court deals a blow to the opposition, and polling agents are detained by police in Harare. In India, peace is making progress throughout the country in the wake of last week's violent riots. And demonstrators in London protest the use of sweatshop labor. But first, these news headlines.
These are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News on International Women's Day, Friday, March 8th. I'm Denise Kovalchuk. Violence continues to escalate in the West Bank and Gaza, with fighting flaring up in Bethlehem, Nablus, and refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. Over 30 Palestinians and at least 5 Israelis have been killed. Fighting's worse in one town, where ambulances have been the latest targets of Israeli fire. Inigal Gilmore reports from Jerusalem.
It seems the heaviest fighting has been in Tulkarm, where a number of Palestinians have been killed, including doctors working in the ambulances there who were shot dead by Israeli soldiers. It is a horrendous death toll that we're experiencing. The Palestinians say this is a slaughter that's going on. The Israelis, of course, have another version to the story. But earlier today, we heard reports of bodies lying in the street, people who were injured and untended by ambulance and medical staff simply because they could not get to them. Several Palestinian ambulances have been shot up, both from the Red Cross and the United Nations ambulances. And they not only have they been damaged, but also ambulance workers have been killed. And therefore, it is almost impossible for them to get to the scene and treat the wounded. The Israelis are claiming that a couple of people working on these ambulances are Hamas members, but this seems like a thin excuse at best to try and deflect the ambulances from doing their work.
That was Inigal Gilmore in Jerusalem. According to Free Speech Radio News reporter Susan Wood, UN Secretary Kofi Annan condemned yesterday's killing of an aid worker who was killed while riding in an ambulance. Annan is urging the Israeli government to find and take action against those responsible. President Bush reversed course last night, announcing he would be sending Mideast envoy Anthony Zinni to the region. The Virginia Senate has passed a law that would forbid second trimester or partial birth abortions. The pro-life movement applauds the bill, but pro-choice advocates say it's unconstitutional because it lacks adequate safeguards for the health of mothers, a stipulation the Supreme Court upheld in striking down a similar Nebraska law. Vicky Saporta with the National Abortion Federation says the Nebraska precedent should make the Virginia law unconstitutional.
The law passed in Virginia is unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court in Stenberg v. Carhart was very clear that women needed to be able to choose the safest medical procedure for them.
Virginia Governor Mark Warner, a Democrat, has said he will sign the bill if it stands up to legal challenge. The Bush administration ousted the head of the Army Corps of Engineers for failing to support proposed cuts to the Corps' budget. Gareth Schweitzer reports from Washington, D.C.
Vocal criticism during a House committee hearing on the Army Corps of Engineers budget led rapidly to the dismissal of the Corps' civilian leader, Michael Parker. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said yesterday that the president believes it is reasonable to demand that administration officials support the president's agenda. Parker, however, has many friends on Capitol Hill who have rallied in his defense, including Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott. But Philip Clapp, president of the National Environmental Trust, points out that the Corps' budget has traditionally been loaded with pork projects, many of which have been criticized by environmental groups. Clapp added that the current antagonism between the White House and Congress over Parker's dismissal will further impinge upon efforts at reform.
I think in the long run, the controversy over Parker's dismissal is going to harm efforts on Capitol Hill to get the Corps into some sort of a reasonable and more environmentally sensitive and more financially rational position.
In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
In solidarity with International Women's Day, women and girls all over the world observe the third women's global strike. As many as 40 countries held rallies and protests, including a concert in Prague, parades in London, mobilization efforts in Egypt, Jordan, and Yemen, and noisy demonstrations in Argentina. The global strike intends to raise awareness of the disparity between the wages of men and women estimated at between 25% to 50% and growing. With assistance from Rob Manning, this is Denise Kowalczyk for Free Speech Radio News.
Candidates in Zimbabwe made a last campaign sweep through their party strongholds today following a court ruling that barred tens of thousands of people from voting in that country's most contested presidential race, including thousands of black farm workers from neighboring countries. The Supreme Court, largely comprised of judges loyal to Mugabe, ruled late yesterday to ban those who hold dual citizenship from voting. As the countdown to Zimbabwe's hotly contested presidential election draws to a close, there have been scattered reports of opposition party polling agents being abducted, detained, and beaten. Today, three South African election observers went to investigate allegations that 21 polling agents from the opposition Movement for Democratic Change had been detained at a police station. The observers began their search in Mbare, a low-income Harare suburb. But that was only the start of a lengthy saga, as Zoe Eisenstein reports from the Zimbabwean capital.
How many were there?
There were about 21.
21 of
yes.
them. So why were they arrested today?
Well, it's something I want you to verify from my officer.
Okay.
And what is his surname? Can you write it down?
An officer at Mbare Police Station tells three South African election observers to go and look for the 21 MDC polling agents at Central Station in downtown Harare. The observers say their release is essential for this weekend's crucial presidential poll, which sees President Robert Mugabe face his stiffest challenge since the start of his 22-year rule from MDC's leader Morgan Tsvangirai. Polling agents from both the MDC and the ruling ZANU-PF party will be stationed at booths around the country to ensure there are no irregularities. But the observers struggled to make headway in their investigation as they came up against police officials who didn't know or didn't want to hand over information about the detainees' whereabouts.
Could you tell me Superintendent Mpanda Yetsai or something like that?
One of the observers got a little irate with a police spokesman he managed to reach by cell phone.
To you, sir, that is the point. You know, and we're not trying to be funny, we've just got a job to do. We just want to know what happened to the people, the MDC people that were taken, the people that were taken into custody this morning at Mbare. We just want to know where they are at the moment and what's happened to them.
After well over an hour and lots of negotiating with various officials at Central Station, the observers received confirmation from the police chief that the MDC polling agents were indeed being held, but not at Central. So the observers got back into their vehicles and drove out to the Southerton police station in the heart of Harare's industrial district. They eventually managed to speak to the police chief there and hung around while he came and left his office, made phone calls to other police officers, and eventually assured the observers that 21 had been released and that they could even go and see for themselves. The polling agents were sitting around outside the station in the burning hot midday sun. Their lawyer confirmed all of them had been released, but he said the incident had been plain harassment and a case of trumped-up charges. One of the polling agents, Joseph Gafumbra, explained that they'd been abducted and beaten up by supporters of the ruling ZANU-PF party before being arrested by police. But despite the incident, he says he'll maintain his role as an MDC polling agent during this weekend's voting.
I don't know how things are going to be there, but I'm quite sure that we are going to face it difficult just because it's a stronghold of some people, but we are not afraid to be there. We have to go and witness what will be happening there.
Do you feel that you're risking your life for this?
I'm not afraid just because what we want to do is to change the government, and I'm not afraid of losing my life. Even if I lose my life, I know the remain will be living in a better country, I'm sure.
For FSRN, this is Zoe Eisenstein in Harare, Zimbabwe.
International Women's Day celebrations in India are taking place in a somber atmosphere. The country remains shaken and shocked by last week's carnage in the western Indian state of Gujarat. The official death toll now stands at over 700, though peace groups say it could be as high as 2,000. There are fears of fresh violence in other parts of the country amid reports that the Hinduist BJP-led government has agreed to allow Hindu activists to offer prayers at the disputed site in Ayodhya on March 15th. However, Peace initiatives are gathering momentum across the country, and stories are emerging of people who put humanity first and helped save lives during last week's madness in Gujarat and elsewhere. Sputnik Kalambi reports from the southern city of Hyderabad, where there is also a history of Hindu-Muslim violence.
Chandranagar, a sleepy neighborhood in the Yusufpura area of the old city of Hyderabad. Narrow lanes and houses that look as if they've stood there for centuries. Low roof structures that merge into each other, the one a Hindu home, the next a Muslim. The two communities are evenly numbered, and the locals say there's never been any communal trouble here. Last Friday, though, the old city of Hyderabad was tense. Reports kept coming in, one worse than the other, of how Hindu mobs were on the rampage in Gujarat, of people and property being set on fire, of an unseeing police and a complicit state government. Lakshmibai, a Hindu who's lived in Chandranagar for over 30 years, was in her house when she heard her son shouting to her.
Mother, go see, he said. There's a gang all dressed in black coming here. They have sticks and petrol canisters. When I heard that, I dropped everything and ran to my Muslim neighbors. They were at Friday prayers, but I made such a racket and was crying away. They locked the door and wiped my tears and said they would protect us.
I rushed out of my house when I heard her screams, says Baby Begum. She and two other women who came to Lakshmibai's rescue, Anis Begum and Abida Begum, chased away an armed mob and guarded the house until the police came. Yet, the women complained with some bitterness, Muslims are now being blamed for last week's tension.
We were all at home when they came running. We were at Friday prayers. We didn't know what was happening outside.
There were 10 or 15 of them trying to break down the door. That's all we saw.
We threw water on them and chased them away to save the Hindus. And now some of them are saying our children were involved, that Muslims had threatened them. Our men leave in the morning and only return at night. And on Friday especially, there's no one at home.
We didn't question whether they were Hindu or Muslim. We are all brothers and sisters here. That's all we thought about when we saved them.
Even amidst the madness, there are silver linings, and the three women will be felicitated tomorrow by COVA, a group working for development and communal harmony in the old city. Yet the potential for a fresh round of bloodletting remains if the government allows the extremist VHP to offer prayers in the disputed Ayodhya site on March the 15th. Noor Jahanapa is with COVA and lives in Chandranagar. Mohammed Iqbal runs a music shop in Chandranagar and is also a member of the local peace committee. Both say the carnage in Gujarat has shaken everyone here, and there is resentment at the injustice towards Muslims.
If Hindus are killed, they will stoke up tension. The same thing is true of Muslims. So many people's lives have been ruined, from 6-month-old babies to 60-year-olds. They didn't spare anyone, so young people here are angry that the criminals get away, and it's innocent people who pay the price.
The call to prayer should be a moment of peace. But this Friday, too, the atmosphere is tense in the old city. The police is everywhere, and the streets look emptier than usual. Yet, police had refused permission for a peace rally in the city 2 days ago, due to have been addressed by leaders of all religions. Messages of peace from religious leaders could cause communal harmony, was the apparent fear. But the public ceremony felicitating the three Muslim women of Chandranagar is all the more important, says Ali Asghar of COVA.
During these times of tension, we need to project such positive actions being taken by people. This is a very strong message that goes out that a Hindu family being saved by Muslim women.
And adds COVA's Noor Jahanapa, women need to be in the forefront of all these initiatives.
A woman has very strong feelings, especially where children are concerned, be they Hindu or Muslim. A woman is a woman and will obviously try to save people. And we feel now that we should get out of the house and do something. It's important that women are more active outside the house.
I'm Sputnik Kilambi in Hyderabad for Free Speech Radio News.
On March 8, 1857, women working in clothing and textile factories in New York City staged a protest. They were fighting against inhumane working conditions and low wages. The police attacked the protesters and dispersed them. 2 years later, again in March, these women formed their first labor union to protect themselves and gain some basic rights in the workplace. On March 8, 1908, 15,000 women marched through New York City, demanding shorter work hours, better pay, voting rights, and an end to child labor. International Women's Day was first recognized in 1911, when more than 1 million women and men attended rallies to demand women's right to vote, to work, to be trained, and an end to discrimination. In London today, demonstrators turned out to protest the continued use of sweatshop labor by many major clothing manufacturers. Anastasia Kershaw talks with protesters on the picket line outside the Gap store on Oxford Street in London.
Today, a protest group marches against sweatshops on one of London's busiest streets, on which thousands go shopping every day. It starts outside a large Gap shop on London's Oxford Street. The windows are filled with clothes, while shoppers wander in and out. The protest group is No Sweat UK, marching against sweatshops found not only in Asia, but also on our very doorsteps in America and Britain. The march takes place on International Women's Day because so many sweatshop workers are women, says Mick Duncan from No Sweat UK.
And women really do face the brunt of this. Women make up 80% of the Reebok workforce in Indonesia, for example. Women face, in many of these factories, face forced pregnancy tests, in some circumstances banned from having sexual partners.
This is a worldwide problem, and corporations singled out this evening, like Nike, Disney and Gap, are widely blamed. Campaigner Dion Boff from a London trade union council says people should watch out for who made their favourite sweater.
A lot of normal everyday people like you and I aren't aware of what's actually happening and aren't aware that the products that they're actually buying are being made by people in factories where they have poor health and safety, where they're not getting the minimum wage or a decent wage.
Today's march is about corporations, but No Sweat UK also chases the small British sweatshops. Just one example that spurs people to meet on a cold Friday night is this, says Duncan.
There's a case of a guy who was working in a factory. The lift doors opened. He went to get in the lift. And there was no lift there and he died. A year on from that incident, his wife is still working in the same factory and the lift still hasn't been repaired. And it's that factory's not alone. There are similar dangerous conditions in all parts of the UK.
The most public event today is the march. But other initiatives also launched today as groups use the weapon of joint publicity to raise awareness. Ethical Threads is one of these. A new company supported by musician Billy Bragg. It sources T-shirts from an Ikuagrian co-op. Groups from across the world need to join and fight, believes Dion, who's helped launch the Ethical Threads.
It isn't easy and it is a slog to do, but we managed to get hold of international activists who were aware of organisations internationally who were doing these things. And then there were organisations at home, like one of the partners in this cooperative called Remploy, who find work for people with disabilities. And I think that there are companies like this internationally that could get together with movements that fight for the rights of workers to carry out such an initiative.
Gap might be the object of an angry march in London, but they say they're on the same side as demonstrators, according to US spokesperson Jamie Egerton.
The country itself has to go through an approval process. Then, once the country is approved, we have our factory monitors, and they perform a rigorous evaluation of the factory before even a single order is placed.
He's even ready for more direct communication.
We definitely don't have anything to hide, and when these groups stage different events, we're more than open to speak with them. And if they have information for us to investigate, we'd be very happy to have open dialogue. And we do have open dialogue with a lot of various activist groups and non-government organizations surrounding workers' rights. And we feel that a lot of these groups have the same agenda that we have. We want to make sure that workers are treated fairly. And we want to make sure that they work in a healthy and safe environment.
We start in front of a brightly lit Gap. We finish just blocks away at Nike. Afterwards, all that remains will be a few leaflets strewn on the sidewalk and a last thought from a passerby. Dion has a final thought for concerned people who want to take action after Women's Day ends.
What the general public can do is boycott the products, but also get involved in organisations like the No Sweat campaign and find out what initiatives are happening.
This is Anastasia Kershaw reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
As the United States bombing in Afghanistan continues, the American public has gotten a glimpse of the recent and growing refugee population along its borders. Around the world, displaced people face unspeakable hardships, simply trying to meet their daily needs in regions that are hostile to their presence. In the U.S., documented and undocumented immigrants who try to make a new life for themselves face many of those same hardships. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Kata Mester looks at some of the difficulties immigrant women face that often lock them in cycles of poverty.
80% of the refugees in the world are women and children. The percentage granted asylum in the United States struggle economically. In most cases, they do not have a family relation already in the country they arrive in. Wendy Young of the Commission for Refugee Women and Children.
Refugees are typically people who have had to flee under very dire circumstances, sometimes very quickly, from their country. So many refugees do come without adequate resources to get themselves set up.
According to Young, the needs of immigrant women and children are often neglected. She adds, in the United States, federal assistance is available to asylees, but it is far from adequate and runs out quickly. Immigrant women often take jobs for low wages and work long hours house cleaning, cooking in hotels and restaurants, or as assistants to the elderly. Undocumented immigrant women also work in similar positions. Currently, there are 8.5 million undocumented immigrants in America. Beatrice Maya of the National Coalition for Dignity and Amnesty says, for the past 10 to 15 years, industries have recruited workers from Latin America with promises of a better economic existence, but ultimately exploit them.
Most of the industries that use workers that pay low wages and the hard works, like in agriculture, like in even construction, meatpacking, in the service industries, but all the low-paid jobs, they don't have a way to fill up those jobs with residents, with legal residents or citizens, because obviously legal residents or citizens have the chance to get better-paid jobs.
Both documented and undocumented immigrants are vulnerable in America because they often do not speak English, forcing them into dead-end jobs. Immigrants' rights advocates call on the federal government to make English training more affordable and available. Even so, Mabel Beaudright of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Local 25 in Washington, D.C., says not all immigrant women will be able to learn English.
They work in those jobs, and then a lot of times, their language is a hindrance to them because they do not speak English clearly enough. And then you have a lot of folks that come in, they're already grown, they're old, a lot of them are older women, and they're reluctant to get into the training. And I think it's a lot because of a lot of fear that they have of, well, I don't want to start something that I may not be able to finish or I may not understand. And it gets quite difficult to them because they have pride, and I understand. They're very proud people.
Non-English-speaking immigrants who work legally and pay taxes often have trouble receiving federal assistance for which they qualify. That is precisely what happened to Inocencio Nolasco. Nolasco is from the Dominican Republic and has worked the past 10 years as a personal assistant to the elderly, until 6 months ago when she got injured on the job and could no longer work. Over a period of 5 months, she spent all of her savings on rent and utilities before she sought welfare assistance.
I went to the welfare office because I was 5 months without working. I spent my savings paying my rent and my utility bills. It was a horrible day because I arrived there at 8 o'clock and I left at 6 p.m. I met with a supervisor who did not speak Spanish and I did not speak English, and he was not helpful. He asked me to sit and wait in the waiting room until someone showed up in order to interpret for me. I felt like I was a victim of discrimination because although he was telling the interpreter certain things in English, the interpreter would not interpret properly to me and just kept on asking me whether I was a United States citizen.
Recent immigrants are facing more of an uphill battle. The Bush administration's newest proposals for welfare ban immigrants who came to the United States after 1996 from receiving federal assistance. Karen Narasaki is from the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium.
President Bush ignores a fundamental reality. Immigrants are human beings. Does President Bush intend for us to be a country who seeks to benefit from the labor of immigrants in the good times, yet turns our backs on them and their families in times of crisis? President Bush's stated rationale that he's afraid that providing a humane safety net will encourage welfare dependency, Yet immigrants come here precisely because they're seeking a better life with freedom and dignity for themselves and their children. They want to work.
Most importantly, say human rights advocates, in order for immigrants to America to succeed and become contributing members of society, they need to be extended the same opportunities and privileges enjoyed by citizens. In Washington, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kutta Mester.
Wangari Maathai is the founder and leader of the Greenbelt Movement in Kenya, a program that has empowered mostly rural women there to plant more than 20 million trees. She's won many international awards for her work. Maathai is teaching this semester at Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, where she spoke with Free Speech Radio correspondent Melinda Tuhus.
Wangari Maathai says she is a very lucky woman because although she grew up in a poor farming family in Kenya, her parents believed in education for girls. She won scholarships to high school in Kenya and to college in the U.S., and upon returning to her homeland, she became the first Kenyan woman to earn a Ph.D. In 1977, Maathai was teaching at the University of Nairobi. She said rural women told her of their struggles to find firewood for cooking, of the lack of building materials, of the soil washing away due to erosion, and of subsequent water contamination.
I quickly felt that maybe that was just one of these inspirations that sometimes hit us, that I thought, well, why not plant trees? It is a movement that is that was initiated to meet the felt needs of local communities. And this has been and continue to be the guiding light, that we respond to the needs of communities and then empower them. And that's a very important word, empower them, so that they can do this for themselves rather than wait for the officials, the government, the aid agencies to come and do things for them.
Maathai describes growing up in rural Kenya in the 1950s and how things changed.
I would go to the river, a very small river. It's really a stream, a very small stream, which was next to our household. And I would go and fetch water right from the river and bring to my mother. And we would drink that water straight from the river. It was so clean. And it was literally gushing out of the ground. Then I came to America, and I stayed there for almost 5 years. And by the time I got back, guess what? They had introduced cash crops. There were coffee, there were tea, where there had been woods and bushes and woodlots. All these had been cut down to make way for tea and coffee.
Maathai said a huge fig tree had towered over her home and the nearby stream, but it was cut down to make way for export crops.
Well, what happened? As the tree disappeared, so did my stream.
Planting trees through the Greenbelt Movement is both an end in itself and a path toward self-determination, Maathai says. The movement includes civic and environmental education and advocacy for the rights of both the rural and urban poor and against political corruption. That advocacy promotes women's leadership, but it has also landed Maathai and other members of the movement in jail occasionally over the past 2.5 decades. But she says it's worth it.
At least they are aware now that the government does not have a right to these resources, that the government is a custodian of these resources, that these resources belong to the people, both those who are here and those who are yet to come.
Maathai says knowledge must precede action, and that's why education for girls is so important. While Kenyan law now mandates equal education for girls and boys, the reality is far different. Maathai says obstacles to education for girls include family poverty, the cultural norm of early marriage, and the religious beliefs of some communities. But Maathai is adamant that problems can be solved with the right attitude and mutual support.
Understand that you can make a difference, even if you're only a few, you can make a difference. The important thing is start. No matter how small the action is that you are doing, start and sustain it.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
Vanessa Tate produced this International Women's Day edition of Free Speech Radio News. Amy Pomerlow and Jade Paget-Seekins provided technical support. Headlines editing was done by Denise Kovalchik and Rob Manning. I'm Nell Abram.